The International Council on Development and Learning has short courses coming up, along with our certificate courses, at icdl.com/courses. Check out DIR 441, Affect-Mediated Motor Development, taught by Mary Beth Crawford, a DIR physical therapist. Motor systems are critical to an individual's overall growth and development. This course will emphasize how motor development supports the functional, emotional, developmental capacities and how developmental growth within the FEDCs also supports motor development. On June 2nd, DIR 404, Treating Fears and Phobias in Young Children, a repeat of this successful course by psychologist Dr. Karen Levine. And I will be offering my course, DIR 402, Be Sure, Supporting, Understanding, and Respecting the Expectations of Parents, for practitioners, live online Wednesday, June 19th. Check out the times in your time zone at icdl.com/courses.
You're listening to Affect Autism, where affect is the number one tool we use in supporting child development through playful interactions.
Welcome, listeners and viewers. This week, I have returning guests, special educator Jackie Bartel and speech-language pathologist Bridget Palmer, who are both DIR experts and coaches in the International Council on Development and Learning's home program, and who both teach courses at ICDL. We also have another parent, Amy McMunn. It is her first time on our podcast. She is the mother of two young adult autistic sons and a spelled communication practitioner who has a couple of dogs. Welcome, all of you. So lovely to have you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for including me.
All of today's guests are in New York State, and I'm across the lake just outside of Toronto. Our topic today is a long overdue one: presuming competence, one of the pillars of the DIR model, Developmental Individual Differences Relationship-Based Model, DIR Floor Time. And I wanted to start the podcast by reading an excerpt from the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network's Parent Handbook. On page 18, they have a section called Presuming Competence, and I am going to read directly from it parts of that chapter. Presuming competence means knowing that your child has thoughts and feelings. It means knowing that your child can understand and learn new things. Presuming competence also means having high expectations for your child. Your child has the potential to live a happy and full life. That potential hasn't changed because of getting an autism diagnosis. If your child shows interest in doing something, you should help them explore that interest. You should help even if others say it would be too difficult for your child to participate. Work to make sure that your child gets the same opportunities as kids their age. Jackie, I'll go to you first. What does presuming competence mean to you?
It's an evolution. When the term first came into being, we all talked about, I'm presuming competence. And it was sort of more like, I'm going to be nice to you and I'm going to say it's okay for someone who has a diagnosis, could be part of what we're doing. But as I've gone along and interacted with lots and lots of people, what I've realized is that it's much deeper than that. There's much more to it. And it has more to do with presuming that the person in front of me has something to share, has an idea, and has an amazing capacity to experience this world and share with me that capacity to experience this world. And what I have to do as a practitioner and just a human being is open my ears and my eyes in a different way to give me the space to really presume competence.
Bridget, what does it mean to you?
Well, what I really like to think about is similar to Jackie, the idea that everyone I'm with, I'm going to presume that they understand. And I'm going to presume that I'm a part of the relationship with them. I'm going to attune to that person. And if I need to think about my facial expressions, my affect, my intonation, the words that I use, using an AAC, an augmentative and alternative communication device, that I want to really be attuning to the communication partner I'm with. If they're understanding me, my intent to communicate, I'm understanding their intent to communicate. How are they letting me know things? We know that some people use spoken words and spoken language to communicate, but we're all using lots of ways to communicate together. And we never want to think because someone isn't talking with spoken words that they don't have something to say and that they don't have desires, wishes, ideas, and that there's lots of ways to convey information, which I know Amy will talk a lot about. And in presuming competence, I'm presuming that they can be a communication partner. I'm presuming that they can be a friend. I'm presuming that they can be in the world in the way that they are as themselves. And so I'm respecting who they are, and I'm listening to adults, neurodiverse individuals, whether they're typing, whether they're using augmentative and alternative communication, whether they're using spoken word. So I'm going to listen and I'm going to presume their competence in the relationship with me.
I am so happy this week to have Amy with us because listeners of the podcast know that my son has almost always been verbal. Even though he had severe brain inflammation at age 2, his speech and language did return, and he's very, very talkative. And I feel a little bit ill-equipped when I discuss non-speaking individuals and alternative and augmentative communication because I don't have experience with it. And so I'm very eager to hear your story, Amy. And I thank you so much for being on the podcast to share your story. Your sons are now in their 20s. Tell us about your journey.
You know, I just think back, our topic is presuming competence. And that is the very last thing that parents were told to do, were taught to do. It's the last thing that was ever modeled long ago. When my boys were first diagnosed, my older son was always in the early intervention system, my younger son as well, but my older son, he's my non-speaker. And he was finally diagnosed at 2, but he was a veteran in the early intervention system already at 2. He was a veteran. And I remember the person who diagnosed, I was just, you know, a young mother doing the best I could. I didn't know anything. And I didn't know anything about autism. And I remember getting that diagnosis and slowly it was dawning on me that this isn't any little thing, is it? How serious is this? And I was told extremely serious. 95% will have mental retardation. They will never hold down jobs. He will never live independently. You need to grieve the child that you thought you had, and you will walk out of here with a completely different life. And he was right. I walked out with a completely different life, but none of what I was told actually at this point has come to fruition. My goodness, how we got it wrong. But I spent most of my older son's younger years trying to fix it. You know, it's that medical model of you've got something wrong, and so we're going to fix it. And those were in those early days where we had Defeat Autism Now, the DAN movement, DAN doctors, DAN allergists, DAN nutritionists. And we traveled the East Coast of the country going to different DAN doctors and trying to fix. I remember having a DAN nutritionist who I would consult with on the phone monthly. And she would say about, oh, we're going to try this vitamin or that vitamin. And, you know, we were just trying to fix it. We didn't tell anybody that our son was diagnosed. We didn't want him to be labeled as anything. And really that's the approach is, how do we fix it? How do we pile on therapies and interventions and whatever it is we can come up with to change the situation, to somehow get us out of the situation. It wasn't really until more recently that my sons have come into young adulthood, are developing their own identities. One in particular is a very proud member of the neurodivergent community. He educates me every day on my missteps, but I am so grateful to have a different perspective on it all. Along with their diagnoses, sure, there have been problems. There have been so many problems along the way. But I think a lot of the reason why there have been those problems is because they have been made to live in a world that did not presume competence, did not understand their diversity, and didn't respect not only their diversity, but them as individuals. My older son is a non-speaker, but he communicates using a letterboard, much like this. And he spells out his thoughts on this. Did I think that he was able to do that? No, I didn't dare hope. I had glimpses of it when he was probably 11 or 12 years old. A speech therapist, old school, getting ready to retire. And she said that, she had learned along the way that if you boiled language down to the very basic elements of yes and no, cards, yes, no, that you could get some communication. And she did with him. So for a while, that was life altering. She called me into her office and she said she had written down everything that she had asked him and everything he had answered by those yes, no cards. And he knew what a checking account was. He knew who the president was. He knew what yellow fever was. He knew, geography. And I remember leaving her office and going out into the parking lot, just trying to hold it together. And I got into my car and I cried and, eager to try it myself. I've fashioned my own yes, no cards, wrote them on a sheet of paper. And I remember one day just going upstairs after school. And I was thinking as I was walking up the stairs, he's 11. What would you say to your 11-year-old for the first time? What do you ask? Like what? I opened up the door and I had those cards and he saw them and he went, "All done." And it's after school, Mom. I don't want any of that. And I went, "I just want one question. I want to ask one question." And I went blank. I just really had no idea what I was going to ask him. And then I just said, "Are you happy?" And he went, "Yes." And whether, I didn't dare hope that that was purposeful. I didn't dare hope that that's really what he was saying. But that was the beginning of it. A couple years later, we did find our way to spelling to communicate and learned on a letterboard, which is what he uses now. He's had a long road. He went legally blind about 5 years ago. All communication stopped with that. Autistic catatonia. Came in to play as well, but he did eventually find his way back to the letterboard and is communicating with me through it. In fact, I even asked him today, I asked him what it is that he would want to say, quite honestly, and he has given me permission to share this information about him, because I also believe that presuming competence means that we don't overshare personal information about our autistic loved ones. I know a lot of people do, but recognizing their privacy, if they're not there to be able to say, "Don't do it," then don't do it. But he did tell me, "Yes, please go ahead and share." He's traumatized. He doesn't feel as though he's capable of anything. He doesn't feel as though he's been successful with anything in his life. He has a bleak outlook on the future. I'm trying to help him with that trauma and processing 2 decades of it, of being told where to sit, where to stand, how you feel. I can't even begin to unravel that. And I'm just a mom. I am just a mom. But he did say to me, "What I would want people to know is that everybody deserves a chance. Everybody deserves a voice. Everybody deserves a future. And everybody deserves a right not to be left in the corner of the room to rot." Mm-hmm. And I, unfortunately, I do feel as though that is his experience. My very final thing, and I'll let some of you also talk, and thank you for giving me the microphone for a little bit. About a year ago, he graduated from school. He got an extra year because of COVID, so he was 22 years old when he graduated. And after the ceremony, we went down into his classroom to gather his things. There were between 5 and 10 people in the classroom. It was a pretty open classroom. And his teacher was gathering things and told him that he needed to go potty, which is another thing of mine. You know, presuming competence means that we don't say to our 22-year-old that you need to potty. But you know, okay, it's time for you to go potty. And I really stood there horrified, between 5 and 10 people in the room, and he was told, go there, stand there, pull down your pants, get them all down. Good. All right. Your pants are down. Sit down. And there he was, just used to being told what to do. He was just beaten down, sitting on the toilet, completely exposed in front of all of these people. And I remember thinking, you know, over my dead body, is this going to be the rest of his life? We have, you know, at home, at home, he is saying these things to me. We've gotten it wrong. And I'm now seeing him in burnout. I'm seeing him with mental health concerns, self-confidence concerns, and all because of the way that society has told him, has programmed him that he can do. To me, presuming competence is a very personal thing. I've watched the story play out in front of me. And I've watched my own role in it. I've watched my own evolution in it. But I'm right now, we're in the living in the damage part of the story.
Thank you so much, Amy, for sharing all of that. Whew, that's heavy, very heavy. I have so many thoughts in response to that. Number one, I just feel for the situation that all of you have been through. I feel for you as a mother, wanting to do the best, not knowing how, not being equipped, not being supported. I feel obviously for your son who has been in the circumstance that you described. I feel fortunate that the neurodiversity movement has come and educated us. I feel fortunate that my son was born later and that we have access to this new information.
Yeah.
In ICDL's parent support group that I facilitate weekly, there are parents of very young children using AAC as very young children. And I think that is such a newer thing that is becoming more mainstream. Right. And hopefully podcasts like this will get the word out so that people who aren't using it will get around to using it. I know I see other kids who are the same age as my son, who's 14, who are non-speaking, who have never been introduced to AAC. I struggle with what to do about that, because who am I to tell them what to do? At the same time, I think maybe if they knew, they would want to get that information. So there's so many things floating through my head. I'll go back, circle around to Jackie.
So I think that, you know, what as I listen to Amy's story, and as Amy said, she's living in the damage now, but the fact that a space has been opened because of the neurodiversity movement and because of this opportunity to be able to communicate with her son, and this the embracing of he can, that is opening up a space that perhaps might not have ever been opened up. And without that, the notion of the presumption of competence, that may never have happened. And what you know, in the space that Amy finds herself in, I know I find myself in, when I'm interacting with families and with individuals, neurodiverse individuals who are adults, and having to work really hard with myself to remember the person before me has the capacity to communicate and to deliver ideas. And I have to change what I'm doing to receive that information. And, you know, it goes so much to what Bridget shared about how do we attune to that person so that we give them the space. And I sometimes am in a position where I can go, boy, I don't know. But to be comfortable in saying, I don't know, but I want to be with you to see if we can figure it out. It means that I have to change what I'm doing. And that's the important piece. That's when we start to move forward. You know, just as you described, Amy, you know, when with your son, you're communicating with him with those letter boards, and you're opening the space. Tell me. That's what's so important.
Bridget?
I think about communication, and I think about each of the parents that I've spent over 20 something years with. They may not yet know how to build a communication system that will support their family, but Daria knows that she's interviewed many people, and you, Amy, you know, and Jackie knows, and I know, we can support communication. There are lots of ways to support communication. You can use a voice output device. You can use photographs. You can use sign language. You can use pointing. You can lead by the hand. You can watch someone's eye gaze. You can tune into what they're doing. And that a multimodal communicator, which we all are all of the time, is what we want to encourage. And I love that you had yes, no, because the speech language pathologist that you had created one system, and there are lots of systems. And if we don't know what those systems are, we can be curious, we can explore, but we first observe, how does the person you're spending time with, well, what are they interested in? What are they doing? How are they responding to you? And what are they letting you know? They're letting us know, and we tune into what that is. And thinking about the opportunities of what systems are available and how do you use them, and to really be available for being a communication partner. And what is it like to be in communication with someone else? And how do you tune into them, respond to them, build reciprocity, and then get into that opportunity for shared social problem solving? What if I don't understand Jackie's message? I'm going to stay with Jackie until we get to a place where I can understand, or we both decide something together. And we do that by being engaged and connected, and being persistent and presuming competence. Mm-hmm. It's such a valuable thing. And we also respect when someone doesn't understand us. And we say, how else can we convey this message? How can I clarify? And so it's being available to thinking about, what does the other person understand? How are you conveying your message? How can you clarify and think about the opportunity for repairing?
Thank you. I did want to go back to a couple of points and then move on further with this. If people remember or can go back to my podcast with Kieran Rose and Dr. Amy Pearson on their new book, Autistic Masking, they talk about a lot of the things that our guest Amy has discussed, burnout, mental health issues, trauma, and the cost of not presuming competence and not supporting autistic people. It really strikes me how much this impacts people, just having that ability to communicate. And communication is certainly a very, very large part of presuming competence. But I want to refer people back to that podcast on autistic masking for sure.
So I know that while our story is focusing on a lot of the trauma that has come along with their neurodivergence. Today's day and age, I love that there is a change in the winds of the neurodiverse community, and that they are loudly and proudly taking ownership over their diversity and a pride in their diversity. And it's a completely different world today than it was 2 decades ago when we first entered, when it was gloom and doom and mental retardation and no future. And now we have members of the community proudly saying, I'm an ADHD, I have a PDA profile, and you know, what their superpowers are. Sure, that we all have struggles. We all have struggles. But highlighting the pride in the community, I think, is going to be all of the difference moving forward. And I'm so grateful that this is the world that we live in today, and this will be the world that my sons will come of age and into their adulthood and be able to create their own lives.
And Amy, now that you are a spelled communication practitioner, you are getting to share what you've learned and help others. And I imagine that's been a rewarding experience. How old are the people that you work with?
I can work with all ages, but by and large, my caseload consists of adults. I have a lot of people in their 30s, so 20s and 30s. You know, people whose loved ones have been along this ride with them and have tried all those traditional things, were told all the same things that I was, and they've gotten to this point where, you know, they find a way. You find a way to communicate, right? Just like Bridget was saying, you know, whether it's grabbing your hand and leading you. And it's amazing for me to watch the love between caretakers and, you know, their neurodivergent individual in their lives, and how they have learned to come to an understanding with one another. It's also been an extreme joy for me to be able to sit next to them and to help them show that they are thinking, that they have lots of opinions, they have lots of abilities, that the world has gotten it wrong. I consider it, it's a very special place for me to be in. It's a full circle moment as somebody sat next to my son and helped unlock his thoughts and helped to teach me to approach him differently. That I can now do that with other families.
The notion of presuming competence plays across everyone who's involved in this. So being able to presume competence within the caretaker, that they have the capacity to communicate with their loved one in a very different way, is so, so important. And delivering that message to everybody involved it's been a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch.
Jackie, you mentioned it's about changing me. So the person who is the practitioner or the parent, the teacher, whoever's interacting with the autistic child or young adult, it's such an important thing. And Jackie and I have had a lot of private conversations lately about my presuming competence with my own son, who's very verbal, because he's 14. But developmentally, in a lot of areas, he's more like a 7-year-old. Academically, he's there. His interests, other things like that. And it's been a real challenge for me, having felt like the mother of a toddler for almost a decade with him, when he really blossomed into more of a school age boy after COVID developmentally, to shift that mindset and treat him like the young adolescent that he is. That's, you know, getting him to do more things that he's perfectly capable of doing by himself. But like a lot of parents whose children have gone through medical trauma, you just feel for your child and you just want to do everything for them and you want to make things easy for them. And it's doing a disservice because he's not gaining those independent skills. I also wanted to bring up the idea of boundaries and having a way to set boundaries that presumes competence as well in an appropriate way. Jackie wants to say something about that.
And I think what's important here is that you know your son very well, and I know him as well. We do not want to force people to do things that they're really uncomfortable with because, you know, and there's a list a mile long of reasons why. So, and that is part of the presumption of competence. I want to be sure that we clarify that we want to assume competence about intellect, but we also want to assume emotional competence, that the person before us has the capability of experiencing and articulating their emotional experience, and that we have to honor it and respect it, even when it doesn't fit with what our bigger plan was. It is so important because, you know, you go to what Kieran Rose talked about and what Amy so nicely shared with us. All of a sudden, we can be forcing people to do things that are really, really emotionally icky, painful. You know, we could give it a bunch of terms, and I know Amy has experience with it.
So this leads us to my other son, my 20-year-old. He has speech. He has a lot of really great and articulated speech. He has ADHD, and he also has a profile called pathological demand avoidance. So he is a PDA autistic. A lot of PDA individuals have trouble with school. And many PDA individuals don't attend school. The traditional school model does not work for them. And before I even realized what I was doing, presuming competence in him and in his ability to recognize his own limits. And it really wasn't I don't like. It was, I can't. My nervous system cannot do this. We did have a couple years where, you know, the powers that be say, but he can't have services at home and he can't have this. And so you try, but I just watched the sparkle in his eye, that joy for life that he had. And it was just, that light was just extinguished. And that he carries that with him today. He's so damaged from it, went right into burnout himself. And he is the one who taught me about autistic burnout. I didn't even know what it was. He researched it. He knew what he was feeling and he told me. So, it did not fit into my plan, to be a homeschooling mother, but that is exactly where we have been. He's been home with me for over a decade. Presuming competence looks different in my household with each. It's the same thing, but it looks different. Those labels, presuming competence, and those labels, high functioning, low functioning, profound, severe, they're so damaging. They're so damaging. Imagine being in the classification that is labeled severe, low, unable. Imagine how that would affect you. But in a different way, and with my other son, he's in the category that is termed high. And so everybody expects that, well, because it's termed high functioning, he should be able to do X, Y, and Z. And the pressure is just incredible to him. And so it's having competence, not just, well, you're high functioning, meaning you can do all this. You can do, it is saying your limit, you know, your limits. And if this is crushing to you, then I will validate that and we will find our way. It looks very different for both of my boys.
And I really want to dive into this a little bit more because it's confusing for a lot of people to unpack it when you say, your son said, it's not about I don't want to, it's that I literally can't. My nervous system can't. How does a parent take those apart? Like, what is my child competent enough to do, not wanting to, versus this is pushing my limits and I literally can't? And I think part of that is the behavior. Jackie pointed out, you're not able always to trust the speech, because sometimes you'll just say what you think people want to hear. You've been trained in a certain way to say things, but the behavior tells us a lot. You know, I know that if my son is in a meltdown mode, I know he's had too much. You know what I mean? I can see that he's had too much, and we just need to calm things down. So Bridget, do you want to start to unpack that a little bit?
Well, what I really appreciate is you're actually describing that there are these situations where maybe I as a neurotypical person don't want to do something, but that's a humongous difference between not being able to because my sensory system or my emotional system or my motor system or my communication system actually are inhibiting or interrupting. I can't think of a word right now. There are definitely adults, neurodivergent people who say, I lose the ability to speak. I lose the ability to use my body. And so I guess I'm going to repeat, but if we're presuming competence, we're attuning to someone, we're respecting them, and we're listening, watching, and noticing, school refusal or not wanting to go to school, there's a reason. They're letting us know there's a reason. And we know that there are systematic things in school settings that do not support our neurodivergent loved ones. There's just no kind way to say that. The systems are flawed. But listening and observing and attuning to the people that you love, they're going to let you know if they have a stomach ache every day. There's a reason they have a stomach ache every day. And relationships built on security and safety, maybe those are at home or in another learning environment. There are lots of learning environments. Trusting that the person is telling you things and what they're telling you is important.
That's where I think there's a fine line and a danger in that term, presuming competence, because we don't want people to get that idea the same way that people using the label high functioning have that idea that, oh, you're competent, you can do it. And that's that danger of the term presuming competence that we want to discuss. So while we do want to assume that someone has competence and the capacity to have feelings, have thoughts, have wishes, have desires, have abilities, we don't want to be the one that commands them on demand. We want each person to have their own agency.
We want them to have their own agency. Yeah, it is. It is establishing that intuitive connection with another person. I think that's at the heart of it. And so that is exactly what I've done with both of my boys in their different sort of situations. You're just connecting to who they are and validating it.
It means listening, but listening beyond, oh, I hear what you're saying. It means listening with all of the components we can see in a person when they're tipped towards that unsafe place, when there's real discomfort. We talk about that balance. We want things to tip towards good. But when we notice that the balance is tipping towards bad, then we have to reassess. And I think that those are the pieces that one really has to tease out. And that's why this is not a do this or do this. It's a understand who is the person in front of you and understand their entire profile. You know, because how they communicate has there's so many facets to that. And I think that's really the important thing, and really zooming into, I understand what you're saying to me. I understand that you have an emotional life, and I'm going to be respectful of that.
And as I've discussed in other podcasts on other topics with other people, using the DIR model, you know, we always talk about process-oriented learning and that everything is a process. And I think it's so important to involve our children in that process. So, you know, maybe I sit down with my son and I say, what are we going to do about this? You know, what are your thoughts about this? And presuming competence doesn't mean we don't offer support. So I think a big part of what Kieran and Amy were trying to get across in their book is that you presume competence, but you're also accommodating support needs and empowering somebody. So especially as a parent, we want to be there to support our child's potential. So that's going to look completely different depending on the child's age, the child's developmental capacities, the child's individual differences, their sensory profile. Everybody has different access needs and support needs.
You know, and Dari, I think what you just described, sitting down and having a conversation, that right there is such a lovely way of presuming competence, because you're not making an assumption about the reason why. You're opening up an opportunity and a space to have a conversation so that you can really understand what's happening. And meeting the person, in the example of your son, as a 14-year-old, even if how he looks on a variety of different measurement tools says 7. Emotionally, he's not 7. Emotionally, he's 14.
And he has the memories and experiences, 14 years worth.
Exactly.
And, you know, talked about this in the podcasts about feeding, how you can sit and plan meals and get your children involved, help them pick what should we have on Monday, what should we have on Tuesday, what do you want in your lunch, so that they're giving that input, so that when they then have the meal and they say, I don't want this, but wait a second, you helped me pick it out, right? Getting their input into planning as opposed to just having everything done to them and for them all day long. That's a process that some parents naturally do, maybe from too early an age, and other parents do it too late an age, like me. And, you know, there's a balance, and everybody's different, of course, but really involving our children in their own life, in planning their own lives and making decisions about their own lives from a young age, I think is a big part of presuming competence. That's certainly what I'm working on right now with my not 7-year-old.
I love it.
Going through a skills test with my 22-year-old right now, with as part of a, you know, just a casual program that he's involved in. And those skills questions, you know, I know who my support system is. I know who to ask for help and how to do it. I know all those things at 22. Even a lot of our special ed students should have gone through, but for whatever reason, my son did not. And it's overwhelming for him to look at his life now at 22. Nobody has asked him questions like that, myself included, guys. You know, it's a process for parents too. Nobody's asked him questions like that. A week leading up to his graduation, his curriculum was, what kind of clothes do you wear in winter? You know, there was nothing about developing agency, fostering that independent thinking, asking what he would like out of his own life. And the first time he went through those questions, He just completely shut down. He just wanted to leave the room. It just, he felt awful. He felt stupid. He feels as though his life is a foregone conclusion. So as I said, we're living in the trauma of it now, but I love that you're even thinking that, and no, it's not too late. Too late. I don't even think at 22, it's too late. He's got a lot of life to live. So I think it's great, and kudos to you. I wanted to offer you that perspective that here we are at 22 facing things that just have not been a consideration for him because of the lack of presumption of competence.
And I, you know, I interact with parents of children who are 10 years younger than my child, and I say, this is what I would have told myself. You know, you have 10 years on me, so, you know, use these tips. And I feel you saying that to me, and I've heard Dr. Gil Tippy talk about working with adult autistics in their 30s and 40s, and how he sees such developmental blossoming in those decades. So there, we're always developing throughout the lifespan. We know this now from neuroscience. A brain is plastic, maybe less plastic than when we were young, but there's always room for potential and growth. And I think the trauma piece is something that's very, very difficult. I have not had a podcast on that yet. I know a number of practitioners that do present about trauma. There'll be one to two, two of them presenting at the New York City conference, ICDL conference, which I believe is happening this weekend when this podcast is being published. Two practitioners there, one presenting on trauma, one that has presented on trauma in the past. And I've sort of put off going there because I feel like I'm not worthy of having that discussion. But it is an important discussion to go through all of those things. And, you know, I feel like that is something that is going to be such a long journey for you and your son, Amy, unpacking all of that and really helping to build. A personal coach said to me a long time ago, your golden building blocks. So who are you and what are you good at? And what do you feel pride about in yourself? And just really working from strengths, which is really what DIR is about. Like, let's find the strengths, let's see the strengths, let's build from those strengths. And I think that's a good place to start. Bridget?
Well, I love that you came back to strength-based, because when we think about bringing out the best in someone, that's presuming competence. That's thinking about confidence and competence and comfort and control and communication and connection. And if you're holding those things in mind and you're sustaining, then, and you're in a relationship with someone else and they feel safe and secure, then Amy, you can have those conversations because you love your son the most and he loves you, and you're having those difficult conversations. And the opportunity to think about connection and what it feels like to be understood and what it feels like to take a risk and what it feels like to try new things and to do the things you do great, do them great. I had a family a few years ago, and it was probably a three-year-old, and I was sharing presuming competence with the mother. And I remember she said something like, no one's ever told me that before. And in this audience, he's young, but to her, it felt like a lifetime that no one had shared that with her. And I was so grateful because it had been shared with me. And then I can share it with others. And to be able to pause and say, I see you. I can't wait to know what you wish for and what you hope for and what your ideas are. I love that.
And one thing we didn't really jump on that Amy had brought up as well, well, a little bit, Jackie talked about it, but that whole, what's the word, infantizing, yeah. Somebody, like speaking to them as if they're still a toddler or a baby, or, you know, that tends to be what people do. And I've heard advocates talk about this. I've heard many people with different types of disabilities talk about this, like someone's in a wheelchair and someone comes up and talks to them like a baby. I'm like, I'm a grown adult, middle-aged adult, and you're talking to me like a baby because I have a wheelchair. It's just something that our society tends to do. And, you know, having, you know, being able to educate people on that whole, you know, speaking to people as if they are, well, they are equal human beings.
You know, I think, Daria, that thank you for really for bringing that up. And I think one of the reasons it's important that we as human beings, we reflect back on ourselves about why do we find ourselves in that space where we infantilize people. I mean, your example about the person in the wheelchair, and I can't put any kind of feeling into anybody else's brain, but sometimes I think it has to do with discomfort and lack of understanding and need for control. And that is such a big part of this. You know, I can speak from my own profession, is that teachers are supposed to teach and children are supposed to learn. And the way that they're supposed to do that is to be compliant to what I decide is important, which means that I'm the controlling force. And the moment that I let go of the control, there's the potential for all kinds of, from some people's perspective, chaos to happen. Or space for people to experience and learn and grow together. And I think that's the, you know, that's a really big part of this, is that we have to reflect on ourselves. What need am I meeting by saying, you know, any of a collection of things that we've talked about today? And it really, it sits in that space of control.
I thank you all for being here and discussing this. There's so many different aspects to it that we could continue to talk about. Do you have any last thoughts, Amy, before we wrap up?
One of the important principles that I learned when I was training to become a spelled communication practitioner was, in presuming competence, you should apply the least dangerous assumption. And so when there is an absence of conclusive data, that you make decisions based upon the assumption that if you are incorrect, so if it does turn out to be incorrect, you will have the least dangerous effect on the likelihood that this person would be able to function independently, and on their mental health. And so I find myself learning it and relearning it as a parent every minute of the day. It isn't as though I was taught this and I had the aha moment and suddenly, you know, I'm perfect in everything that I do. But at little steps along the way, I just tell myself, least dangerous assumption. You know, how can I approach this? Because I am not neurodivergent. I am reminded every day that I'm not. My younger son would even listen to me as I parent him, and very quietly just look at me and then say, "Are you sure you aren't approaching that neurotypically, Mom?" And you know, I am. And so I try with every step to just think of the least dangerous assumption.
So important. Thank you. Jackie or Bridget?
I think that's, for me, that's a beautiful, beautiful closing. The least dangerous assumption. Don't make an assumption.
I think the very last thing you said, Amy, when your son said something like, "Mom, are you coming at that from a neurotypical perspective?" I think I'm going to hold that in mind as well.
Thank you so much. I'm sure listeners have lots of thoughts floating around. I'm sure we missed a lot of things, not having any autistic self-advocates here with us. I'm grateful to people like Kieran Rose who have educated me so much on various topics. I hope you'll reach out if you have any questions. Thank you so much, everybody.
Until next time, here's to choosing play and experiencing joy every day.
Caregivers, I facilitate the International Council on Development and Learning's weekly parent support meetings every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and monthly on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. These are free drop-in meetings to support caregivers implementing floor time with their children. Let us support you in finding the connection and joy with your child as you support their developmental process using DIR. See the events menu at affectautism.com or the parents tab at icdl.com/parents.